That was an outstanding group. They were great. Now, if you tell them to focus, does that work? Focus. I need you all to focus.
Sure.
Yes.
I was sitting back here observing, and when she said focus, I mean, everybody's head in here. Way to go, Pat.
I think you're on to something. I think the difference is she said focus. If I say it, y'all just go on ahead and keep milling around. So I need to have her say focus occasionally. So we're going to begin with a scripture I didn't read, and we're not going to read it. We're just going to kind of review something that we have as a common language of faith, which is back in Exodus. We had the story of the people who are in slavery. They're in bondage in Egypt, the Hebrew people. And God sends Moses to free the people, and it's a long, involved story that's got a lot of twists and turns to it, but the end result is that the people are freed from slavery and bondage in Egypt, and they get away from that. They leave that behind. They leave that behind, and they go into the wilderness. The wilderness is the wilderness. They don't leave it behind and go straight to the promised land, which you'll remember the thumbnail description of the promised land was a land flowing with milk and honey, which sounds like a wonderful place to end up, especially if the place you're at in the meantime is the wilderness, which is by definition not a place flowing with milk and honey. And so when they're in the wilderness, it's not the greatest time. It's not the easiest time for them. They eventually have steady food provided for them by God, but it's the same thing day after day. And so at first they're just unhappy because there's not enough food, and then God provides manna for them, but they're then unhappy that it's manna again. It's still manna. The next day it continues to be manna, until they're a little upset with all the manna and the lack of variety in their menu. And there's a couple of stories where they're, again, in the wilderness, where the water supplies, the sources of water are unpredictable and not always readily available. So there are places where the people are thirsty, and that's a legitimate concern. It's not like they're being irrational when they start asking for water when they don't have water. But the combination of those things is we have several stories of the people after they have left behind slavery in Egypt and gone to the wilderness, where we got these stories where they complain. Like, you brought us out here to die. Back in Egypt, we had enough food. We had plenty of food, and there was a variety to it. It was good food. And when we were back in Egypt, we didn't have to wonder if there was going to be water. There was water. And so there are many of these stories, it feels like, when you read through that section of the Bible, where it's the people who have left behind slavery in Egypt, they're there in the wilderness, and they seem like they can't stop complaining. They can't stop saying, things were so great back there, and now here we are. What gets lost sometimes when people like me stand up and talk about the narrative in that way is, I think, a really important detail, which is that while they were out in the wilderness, they also had something they did not have in Egypt, which was they were no longer slaves. They were no longer forced labor for someone else. They were free. And so while they were unhappy sometimes about the food that was available, or why they are unhappy sometimes because they may not have water right at that moment, what did they never do during that time period? They never all said, let's just go back. They said, we had it better, but that's different than saying it was better. And so there was never a time where they said, this Moses guy's crazy, we're out here, we don't have anything we want, we're going to go back and be slaves again. Because they had come to a point where life was different, and they were experiencing change that was hard, and certainly they were honest about the hardship of it, but they were also free, and there wasn't as though there was going to be this movement of saying, it was so much better that we indeed want to go back. They didn't want to go back. What they wanted was for the promised land to come, and eventually they would get there. But keep that in mind when you hear, again, people like me stand and preach to you about how grumpy the people were. Not grumpy enough to go back. They were steadfast enough to be faithful in the face of those hardships that they faced, and they stuck it out, and eventually they got to the promised land. So we'll come back to those folks and their decision to remain where they were after a while. We are in the final of the 8 weeks going back through the discipleship difference categories again, those areas that describe different aspects of a life of what it means to be a disciple. And again, the idea simply being that it is important to not just say we want to be disciples, but to say what being a disciple means. Because when we start saying what it means, then we can start thinking about where do I need to grow? Or where do I really feel like God's pushing me right now? Or where do I feel like I'm experiencing growth? It is not a thing to say, not a tool to say, where am I coming up short? Where am I falling down? Where am I doing badly? That's not the intent. The intent is to help us to be able to look at this and say, that's an area where I really feel drawn to, and I'd like to spend more of my energy in that. Or I recognize this is an area where I do need to grow, and how can I do that? So we have worked our way through the roots of the tree, the experience of God, the thing that has to begin with God. God initiates that contact with us, and we experience God in our world, in our lives. And then we respond, the second thing, the trunk of the tree, the spiritual responsiveness, and then the different areas. So we've been through sacrificial living, you know, putting others in front of ourselves, generous living, living in a way that doesn't emphasize scarcity, but emphasizes abundance, God's generosity, God's care for us. Disciple making, we're growing ourselves as disciples, and at the same time that's happening, we are to be about the work, the pleasant task of calling others to lives of discipleship as well. Not because they ought to do it, but because it is a wonderful blessing to be able to do that. And if we're experiencing growth and joy in it, it's the kind of thing you want to share the way you want to share anything that you experience growth and joy from. Personal transformation, all these things work together and we start changing. We start becoming something different than who we were. And then last week we talked about authentic relationships. Relationships where you really can say anything to God, be totally honest with God, and cultivating those relationships for ourselves so we're not layering levels of honesty with people around us, but we're really trying to be as fully and completely ourselves, as much truly ourselves as we can be with other people, and trying to allow people to be that way with us, which is easy sometimes and really hard sometimes. But that's why in any of these categories, we have to work at these things. It isn't just to pick the times where it's easy to be in an honest relationship. It's those times that challenge us are the areas where we're going to begin to grow. If enough of us do these things, then things begin to change. Lives begin to change. Our lives begin to change. And we experience some growth, not just as individuals, but in community. And eventually, if enough people live out these categories, live out these areas of discipleship, what happens is not that we get to check off a bunch of boxes to say, now we're living out all the areas of discipleship. But what happens is the world changes. The world changes in the way that God intends. And we move in the direction that God is calling us. And the kingdom that is coming begins to, we begin to see more vividly what it looks like that it is here now, as well as that it is coming. The final piece of it this morning, the one that in a way it's last intentionally because it makes sense as the final piece, is community transformation. And community transformation is kind of like this. It's kind of asking the question, how much different would the world be if everyone thought about what they were saying before they said something unkind? mean, how often have you heard some version of that said? How much different would the world be if we would just think before we spoke, so that we weren't having constantly to retract things that we wish we hadn't said? What difference would that make? How much difference would the world be if each person did a random act of kindness every day? If that just became the part of what we did, that everybody was doing that. Think about the exponential effect of everybody thinking in the direction of how can I be a blessing to someone else in some way each day and acting that out. When one person does a good thing, it is striking a match in the darkness. When one person does a good thing, it is a light that lights up a dark space. But when a group of people do that good thing, so when it's you and you and you, when we begin to do it individually, but as a group with that idea, that match that gets struck becomes more of a bonfire. And the darkness is more and more dispelled because there's more and more light, simply because more and more folks are trying to move in the direction of how do I bring light. Change enough people that way, and you change the world. This can sound like total pie-in-the-sky stuff. Like, we're going to change the world, except that we are supposed to believe that. We do enough of these things, we live as disciples of Jesus, and the world changes. Not only do we change, not only are we transformed, but the world is transformed. This is the easiest idea, really, to get your mind around. It's not like it takes a bunch of imagination to think of what I'm talking about, to think what it might look like to do a good thing each day, and how awesome it would be if everybody was doing that. So it's not hard to imagine, but it is hard to do. It is extremely hard to do, partially for the reason that Pat was talking about with the kids. There's a certain amount of time in each day. And so my random act of kindness for today may get pushed to the side because I got other stuff that's more important. Now, I might not say that out loud. I might not say there's like six things ahead of being kind to somebody that I need to do. But when I'm prioritizing, I may be thinking, I got to knock this out and knock this out and knock this out. And if I have time to kind of do something nice for someone, I'll get to it when I can. But that's not my top priority, except why not? And so this begins to be the thing that where it is easy to understand what it is we want to do, but it can be a challenge to actually do it. It is profoundly difficult at times to live out this goal of being disciples of Christ. Paul, in this passage this morning from Ephesians, this is one of these wonderfully practical, this is such a rich text, and it is a brief text, but being brief, I would encourage you to go back and reread this scripture multiple times this week, because it's one of these where if you go verse by verse, you will have enough to keep you busy in a sort of a devotional moment for as much time as you have to spend with it, because it is so full. He offers instructions to the Ephesians and an idea of what those instructions look like, just to pick a few out of this. He says we should tell the truth to our neighbors. He says we should be angry without sinning. Try that one. Be angry without sinning. You don't have to do it right now, but that almost sounds counterintuitive. Like, why is he telling us to be angry? And we'll come back to that. But be angry without sinning. Don't let the sun set on your anger. He says, thieves shouldn't steal. Instead, they should use their hands to do good. And the reason they should use their hands to do good is because then they can help other people. So he doesn't want the thieves just not only not to be thieves, he wants the thieves to turn into folks who are blessing to other people. Only say what is helpful for building community. I mean, I'm not sure how much I would ever say. And I honestly look at the things that come out of my mouth sometimes. I feel like I would eliminate probably 60-70%. Eliza might go with a higher number than that. If I had to eliminate things that didn't go towards the goal of building up community, which goes to that category of saying things without thinking about them. Or saying things because that seems clever or that seems like a funny thing to say without thinking of the potentially problematic aspects of what it is that you're saying. So the only say things that are helpful for building community. Then put aside bitterness. Put aside losing your temper. Put aside anger. Put aside shouting. Put aside slander. Now, you see what I mean when I say you can go through and spend as much time as you want with any of these things. That was one tiny little bit right there. Put aside bitterness, losing temper, anger, shouting, slander. That could take me a year. I mean, I could spend an eternity just with that little passage right there before I ever moved on to the next thing. So these are wonderful, robust instructions. Then he moves away from the put this thing aside to saying, do these things. Be kind. Be compassionate. Forgive each other. And then he draws it all together and puts a bow on it with be like Christ who loved us. Be like Christ who loved us. These are all things that we can do. Every one of those things, again, not easy things, but they're all things that we can do. This is like a take-home kit. You can go and implement these things. Choose one and work on it. But it's all stuff that one person can do. But they're all things, this is important. Where's Pat? Focus. I need your help. I don't need you to focus, I need you to get them focused. The important thing here is this, that these are all things that you can do and they will make no difference if you do them in a room by yourself. You can go do all these things and if you only do them in a room by yourself, it will make absolutely no difference if you do them. And I think Paul understands that, and I think he knows that, and I think what he's saying is, not only do I want you to do these things, but I want you to do them in community. I want you to understand that the important thing is not just you, but the way you relate to the person next to you, and that relationship you have with whoever is your neighbor. And we know where Jesus went with that. Who's your neighbor? Well, that turns out to be everyone. And so none of these things matter independent of relationship. They matter deeply if we do them in community. They matter deeply in a profound way that can change the world if we do them in community. Not if just I do them in community, but if we all begin to do these things in community, that looks like what the church is. That looks like what the church is called to be. And the church always has the opportunity to move in the direction of being more and more what God calls it to be. Paul understood this thing, which is Jesus did not come to begin a religion. We are a byproduct of what Jesus did, but Jesus' primary purpose was not to begin a religion. Jesus' purpose was to change the world and to do it one relationship at a time. When he comes along with those fishermen in the boat, he says to them, not, come start a church with me. He says, follow me. And begins to change the world one relationship at a time. James and John and all the others, Peter and Simon, Andrew, one relationship at a time. What Jesus does, what the scriptures show us Jesus doing, what Jesus, the living Jesus, continues to do is teach us how to love. Show us what it looks like. Show us when it's beautiful. Show us when it's demanding. Show us when it's hard. But shows us how to love. Not just because he wants us to see how awesome he is at doing it, but because he wants us to do it. He wants us to follow the model of what he's doing. The life of a disciple is living out our lives with love. The more that happens, the more we live out our lives with love, the more not only are we transformed, but our communities are transformed. Whether that community is Ephesus, or whether that community is Bullitt County, Louisville, and Kentucky, wherever these principles are being lived out, wherever love is being lived out, transformation happens. Paul's basic point for the Ephesians and for us is that being a disciple means change. It means there was an old way of life, and as a disciple of Christ, there is a new way of life. Paul talks about in exactly those terms in different places. The new person, or the old person and the new person, and moving from the old life to the new life. Again, it's not hard to understand. It is hard to do. And what you have to get from this passage is that we are a work in progress. We are not trying to become finished products on our own. What we're trying to do is move towards what God is calling us to be, which is why Paul doesn't say this. I made a point of pointing this out earlier, but what Paul says in this passage, he doesn't say to them, never be angry. Wouldn't that seem a wiser thing to tell them, just never be angry, rather than to be angry but don't sin? He doesn't say never be angry. He tells them to be angry without sinning because he knows what? They're going to get angry. If he says never be angry, what is he doing? He's setting them up to fail because they're going to be angry, and then they're just going to feel bad about what they've done. But instead he says, be angry, but don't sin when doing it. Which is, find a healthy way to be angry. Find a way to get along in your relationships. So let's go back to the people at the Exodus again. I want to go back to them. This is a group of people that were thirsty and they're hungry, and it's a hard way of life. I think if we put ourselves in their places, we can easily empathize with them, with how they felt, and understand that they weren't being mean-spirited or irrational or lacking in compassion, or their faith was lacking. It was hard. And so they were asking for food and asking for water and asking for maybe a little something different than manna day after day. But what they also knew was that the new life was worth it. At the end of the day, it wasn't like they were saying, this new life is terrible and I want to go back to the old life. What they're saying is, I'm trying to figure out how I live in this new life, but I like this new life. I like being free. I like not being in bondage. And so I want to live out here in this freedom, but I need to figure out how to do that. Paul's trying to tell the Ephesians and tell us the same thing. We don't want to go back to the old life. We don't want to go back to not wanting transformation. We don't want to go back to being angry and doing it for no good reason and in a hurtful way. We want to live in a different way, but we're going to struggle and it's going to be hard, and we're not going to do it perfectly, but we want to continue to do it. That's discipleship, finding that new, better way of life and not going back to the old way of life that just gives up on everything. So we do things like this. We do things like come to church, come to worship on Sunday morning. Coming to worship on Sunday morning is, again, just as Paul is not giving them a laundry list of activities to check off, I hope and I pray that coming to worship on Sunday morning isn't a box that you feel like you need to check off or God's going to be angry with you. I hope that rather coming to worship on Sunday morning feels like a blessing. Hope it feels for you like if you were a car and you were about out of gas, that you get filled up and that somehow God's Spirit is available to you, which is available anytime in any place, but is available in a particular and a special way in the context of worship, in the context of these folks that you're sitting beside, so that this place becomes that place of blessing and you are renewed here. Worship, I hope, feels like an anchor for your week. Not in the weighing you down kind of way, but in the placeholder sort of way, so that whatever may come, whatever storm may show up, it can't buffet you so much that you don't realize where your anchor is, that you're not firmly anchored in your faith. The faith alongside fellow believers that sustains you. Love becomes the way of life in that community. Sometimes we don't worship. Sometimes we aren't very nice. Sometimes we're not loving. That's just true. That is not a judgmental statement. That is a factual statement. Sometimes we don't worship. Sometimes we're not loving. Sometimes we're not nice. But we want to go back. We want to go back to worship. We want to go back and do those things. We want to do better. We don't want to just say, well, I'm through with all of it. We want to embrace the new life. So I want to point something out to you that you may or may not know, but even the building wants to help you with this. The actual church building is structured in such a way that it wants to help you with this process. And I'm guessing that this is intentional, but in the early church, when they would do their prayers of confession, they would turn to the west and face the darkness and confess their sins before God. And then they would turn and face the east, where the sun, where the light would be, and embrace the light, having experienced the grace of God when they turned and confessed their sins. Now, I want you to think what you are facing. You are facing the west. So you come into worship. You literally are drawn into worship and put in a position of being in that moment of confession, of saying, this is who I am. I know I'm not who you want me to be entirely, but this is who I am becoming. We are in that attitude as we worship of facing the west. What are you going to do in a few minutes? You're going to walk up that aisle and go out those doors, and you are going to go east. You're going to go face the east. Nate's going to get this candle and light that candle, and he'll walk it out there, and that'll symbolically take the light into the world. But when you walk out the door, you're literally walking towards and embracing God's life, saying, I have visited that place, and I've understood how broken I am, and I've experienced the grace of God, and now here I go out into the world again, ready to be a blessing, ready to embrace the light. One at a time. One at a time, we may have an impact, but together. Could go to the you for everyone in here, but together. We can have an amazing impact. We can transform our community. We can transform this community. We can transform the communities where we live, the communities where we work, the communities where we go to school, our state, our nation, our world. We can transform the world because we don't want to go back to Egypt. We just don't. We don't want to go back to Egypt. What we want to do is people who embrace Christ's call to discipleship and want to do this big, amazing, awesome thing that seems very nearly impossible, but we know that we can do it, which is to live as followers of Christ. And when we do that together, we will indeed change the world as God intends. Thanks be to God. Amen.